Joining me today on the podcast is an actor, writer, and producer who loves creating characters and situations based on his own life. In short, Alex Pyers is a storyteller. But he wasn't originally headed toward the actor life, and so changing course came with some hard lessons.
Mind you, I was scammed by businesses that were like, oh, you pay us this money up front and we'll manage you and submit you for stuff. I mean, you don't know any better. And sometimes you have to make those dumb mistakes in order to kind of learn your way.
Welcome to Why I'll Never Make It, featuring conversations with fellow artists about the realities of life in the arts, all while challenging the notion of what it means to make it. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, and for more information on the podcast and to sign up for the monthly Win Me newsletter, go to whyillnevermakeit.com. The process of getting an idea, a story, from conception to production to finally being on stage or on screen can be a rather lengthy process. Hamilton, for example, was a small idea at first for Lin-Manuel Miranda, a mixtape of two songs, that took 7 years to finally blossom into the hit Broadway musical we know today. The movie La La Land was first thought of by Damien Chazelle when he was going to Harvard. He graduated in 2007, but it wasn't until 2015 that the film was finally in production, and then released the following year. And of course, Miranda and Chazelle needed many collaborators and producers and fellow creatives to turn those ideas into shows. Alex Pyers is another one of those with plenty of ideas. He's an actor who came to New York with a mission to not only act, but to write as well. But as we know, having the idea is just the first step on a long journey towards actually seeing it come to life. And sometimes the most random encounters can start you down that path.
Yeah, I'd say like late 2015, early 2016, I had bumped into somebody that I did another web series with, his web series, and on the street in New York, you know, just like in Union Square or something, and it was just kind of very serendipitous. So we started kind of writing some sketches, and they didn't really go anywhere. And I kept finding different creative partners, and the idea kind of kept changing. And it eventually landed to be this. So,
and you went through several other collaborators. What were kind of the ins and outs of going from one collaborator to another until you found one that that you wanted to stick with?
It was a thing where honestly, that dude just kind of ghosted me, you know. And we were buds and colleagues and stuff. So I was a little surprised that he would just kind of interest in it, especially when I thought we had some legs. And then the next two partners, one of them was just straight up crazy and ended up moving back to New England because, you know, New York City was just too much for her, and which I respect, but she definitely had some things to work out. So she bailed. And then after that the next partner just didn't want to be an actor anymore, I guess. So she sort of bailed out on that as well. So I was just like, man, either I'm just having the worst luck in the world, or I am just terrible to work with or something. I don't know what's going on, but I can't get somebody to just commit and try to make something happen. But I just have found in other situations and talking with other creatives that is very much a thing. You know, it's everybody, Kevin Hart has said this in like a state, like everybody wants to be famous. Nobody wants to do the work.
Yeah, right? That's true.
So it's not about fame for me, but it's like, you know, everyone's always talking about, man, I just want to like do something. And like, can we just like create our own stuff? And like, whether it's theater or like a web series or whatever. And I'm like, cool. Got this web series idea. Got some, you know, some loose like scripts, like let's make it happen. And they're like, oh, I can't make it. I don't know. I got a dog to walk, I think. And I got some TV to watch. Oh, maybe we'll just do this later. And I'm like, okay, well, come on, people. So I eventually found Stephanie, who is my co-star in what came to be Peas in a Pod. But it had a long journey of me trying to like figure out who the right person was going to be to actually help me lift this off the ground. And eventually, this was before Stephanie, but I did land eventually from just like two dudes and shenanigans to this platonic male-female dynamic, and then it really kind of expanded from there.
And so last year, Alex released the pilot episode for Peas in a Pod. He created it, wrote it, and starred in it. But like many of us actors, Alex was out there working on other projects too. He was featured in an episode of Punisher on Netflix, as well as various short films and commercials. And of course, he wasn't done with his comedy web series. After releasing that pilot episode in January of 2019, he did some fundraising along with his co-star slash fellow producer, Stephanie Wendland. They filmed the remainder of that first season last summer, but editing can take a little bit of time. As a podcaster, I mean, it takes hours just for one of these episodes, so adding video elements to it makes the process even longer to have the lighting and all the visual elements match the audio elements. So editing is a lengthy process, especially when Alex and the other creatives had those other jobs that they were working on. So 2020 began with the hope of releasing the first full season that would take off and pave the way for future seasons of new episodes. But then came the Ides of March, and the world as we knew it came to a grinding halt. However, there was a bit of a silver lining. You see, with nothing else to do, they were finally able to focus on the series and put the finishing touches on those episodes. And in April of this year, the world finally got the first full season of Peas in a Pod.
So in every rom-com or even any show, the male and female leads always have this will they, won't they thing going on. It's the Ross Rachel from Friends. It's like the JD and Elliot from Scrubs, or, you know, even Seinfeld and Elaine. And that works. It's tried and true. Everybody loves it. But we are in an age where everybody is begging for stories that are true and that are unique and that are interesting. And I think that male and female dynamic with leads that isn't inherently romantic or filled with sexual tension is very real. And there are tons of comedic opportunities that can come from that. So why wouldn't I do that? And to be honest with you, I grew up in a very female heavy family. My family is just full of women. And so my experiences and my upbringing and my perspective is very much from that side of it. You know, it's like a single mother home. I was being babysat by my grandmother, my aunts who always had me. So it's like my viewpoint is almost kind of through that lens. And so my respect for women and my the way that I look at things, I kind of get along with women better than men, to be honest with you. I have more intellectual conversations with women than with men. You know, I can only do so much of like, oh, cars and girls and like, you know, beer. Sports. Yeah. Beer. Yeah. You want an IPA? I'm like, no, I don't. I respect my taste buds. I don't want this, you know, 8.2% IPA, man. I don't want it. And I'm not interested in your truck. So how about, you know, politics or, you know, life? Can we talk about our feelings? And they're like, what are you, gay? And I'm like, oh boy. All right. So women are just a lot easier to talk to. They're the better sex, you know, Pat, let's just be honest. They're the better half of the human
generally
race.
More reasonable and have a better head on their shoulders, I think, a lot of times.
Better leaders, you know, Barack Obama said that best. Women are better leaders. So I took a page out of their book and as a result, I have so many female friends who I'm not trying to sleep with, who I'm not interested in that way and never even thought about it. And we have a great time and a lot of laughs and all that stuff. And so I think it's a very real dynamic that so many people can, connect with and feel seen by. And so I just thought, let's start a show with that dynamic and then dive into all kinds of other things on top of that.
You mentioned growing up with a single mother, which was also my upbringing as well. So women were a big part. My grandmother, my mother, those were two very strong and present women in my life. And so, yeah, so that relationship, so that looking up to and being inspired and motivated by women in my family and the friends that were around me, it really was something that formed how I looked at the world. And so for me, the whole misogyny and that thing and looking just makes no sense to me.
Yeah, it's gross. You know, like when you, especially in a city like New York, when you see this catcalling and all this ridiculous stuff. I mean, my mom never even had to tell me not to do that sort of a thing. I just never even had the urge to do that personally. But when I do see it on the street, it's just it's ridiculous. It's really ridiculous.
Having a strong, supportive mother will make any child feel like they can do anything. They can pursue any profession. And actually, Alex's initial path wasn't to be an actor. He first went to college to study medicine.
There aren't a lot of college grads in my family, and not a lot of, you know, stories of, you know, success in that regard. I'm from New Bedford, Massachusetts, and it's a very small blue-collar town, you know, and a lot of people stay right in there and do their thing, and no shame on that. But I had some pressure to that I put on myself, really, to have a certain level of success, to make my family proud and all that stuff. And to be honest with you, I was genuinely interested in and intrigued by anatomy and physiology and that sort of a thing. So I took AP bio and chemistry in high school and all that stuff. And also, you know, when you watch shows like Scrubs or House or something, you're like, I want to do that. Right. I just didn't realize until I got there that I wanted to do that on TV or in the movies. And to be honest with you, I had already been performing my entire life anyway. Right. So it's not like I had never stepped out into stage or something. And then once I got into college, I decided to do this. I was in 6 shows in my high school drama club. I did, you know, and leads in half of those. I was in, you know, all the choirs that you could be in school. I was writing, I was dancing, I was doing all the things. And so I already loved to do this. It just, you know, I got there and within my first semester, I was like, oh, this isn't going to work. Not even a little bit. I gotta go. So my mom was scared. And I'll tell you what, shout out to Deborah Ramis back in Massachusetts, my mom, who, even though I told her, hey, mom, I'm going to leave college and not transfer to another college, but I'm just going to come back and figure out just like how acting works. She hit me with like one, like, are you sure? And I was like, yeah, I think I definitely want to do this. And she was like, okay. And it's been like undying support, you know, all the way through. And she's now seen some really good success since then to kind of, you know, validate that. I'm just really hoping to get that, you know, get a role as like a doctor or something on some one of these procedurals or something, or like in a movie that like pays, you know, buku bucks or something. So I can be like, see, mom, still a doctor. I still, yeah, best of both worlds and more money than they make in real life. So how do you like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When it comes to support, mothers support like no other. My mom came to every high school, college production I did. And she even flies out as when she can. She, you know, there's that rare instance where she can't fly out, but she'll fly out wherever I am in the country and doing this regional gig, and she'll come see a show. So it's, yeah, there's nothing like a mother's support.
Absolutely. Thank you, mom. Love you.
So you decided to make acting work, however that was going to work. And you stayed in Massachusetts for a while before coming to New York?
Yeah. You know, so I left after my first semester at Masca. So, you know, just, to give people some perspective, this was like a fast track program to be a PA and to basically be a doctor in 6 years instead of 8 plus residency and all this other stuff. Oh, so, wow. You know, and Mass College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, very prestigious school. I have some friends that actually ended up graduating from there as PAs, as pharmacists and all that stuff. But I left and I go home and I literally Googled how to be an actor. And I just went through the rabbit hole of the internet to like figure out of whatever backstage articles and whatever else that I could find at the time. And mind you, I was scammed by businesses that were like, oh, you pay us this money up front and we'll manage you and submit you for stuff. I mean, you don't know any better. And sometimes you have to make those dumb mistakes in order to kind of learn your way. So from there, I just kept, it didn't take me long to book some kind of a job. It was like within my first couple months, maybe, I got a short film with a supporting role that was part of this school, like this college festival that ended up winning and going to LA. So that was like a really like reassuring thing of like, okay, something that I'm involved in was good enough to make it out to LA and get awards and all that stuff or whatever. I was like, all right, I'm on the right path here. from 2012 to 2015, I just was in the New England area, traveling all over the place, doing everything I could get my hands on, you know, student films, industrials, commercials, features, web series, I mean, you name it. And I got in on it to learn the ropes and make enough money to move out here.
And either going to LA or New York, was that a choice that you had to decide on?
I was going to actually go to LA first. So I was going to just pack up, save up money, pack up my car and do like a cross-country road trip, like see the country, get all this like life experience, and then go to LA and be like, boom, ready to work, y'all. Make me a star. And then I was dating a woman at the time who, you know, we were thinking it was going to go be, you know, super serious. And she was actually going to get, she actually got a job at NYU. And so there was that. And then also I happened to get an agent, a really big one, like top five in the country, big, who was, you know, their office, the people I was going to work with were out of New York. So it seemed like the stars were aligning for me to go to New York at least first. And so I was like, all right, I'll go to New York first. It'll be closer to the family. I'll kind of use it as a stepping stone and then move out to LA. But I've been here ever since. And, you know, I see myself sticking around for at least a little while longer.
Yeah, and it certainly provided you with enough material, because if there's one thing that New York is good for, that is people watching.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I will take out my phone and make, while everybody else is on Instagram and, you know, and Facebook or whatever, I'm taking notes of like any really interesting characters I see. Maybe, you know, this is kind of creepy, but like taking pictures of people who have like a really interesting look. And I just save that in an album to be like, I really love like this person's like piercings or their tats or like the outfit choice or whatever. I want to bring that in to play some sort of first version of that. And I've cherry picked some of these qualities that I see in people, whether it's their walk, just like their gait, their posture, something like that, their voice. If I hear somebody with a very interesting voice, I'll try to take that and use that in some sort of a role. But for Peas in a Pod, I mean, yes, it's a New York based show, but it's more to be like, here's what it's like in a big city and not necessarily specifically in New York. But most of the show is based in Brooklyn and Queens. So versus like Manhattan or, you know, any big super popular areas.
And it's a comedy show, but at the same time, you've tackled things like stereotypes and depression and even germophobia. So I mean, you've kind of run the gamut of very serious topics that people deal with.
Well, a lot of those are, you know, every one of those scripts is based on some, you know, something in my own life that I've either blown way, you know, up or inspired by some movie or show or actor that is, that I love or whatever, or kind of all of the above. So yes, it's very much informed. And look, the best comedy is based in truth, right? I can't remember if it was Stanislavski or Strasberg or one of those pillars, but you know, the idea of, you know, you make them laugh and then you stick, while their mouth is open, you stick the truth in there. And you hit them with the real stuff, and that's what's really going to get people's attention, right? I didn't want to just make people laugh and have them be like, oh, that show's cute. I wanted them to be like, oh, wow, like they're saying something and it's super funny.
Yeah, because you personally deal with germophobia. Does it ever like actually affect your interaction and how you go about the world?
So have you ever seen the show Monk?
Yes.
Okay, so I started watching that show at a very young age. One of my aunts, another woman in my family who was babysitting me, was like, come watch this show with me. And I was like, sure. And I don't know why, but I just really loved it. And you know, I'm possibly still in the single digits or maybe very young, like preteen when I'm seeing this. So very impressionable. And Tony Shalhoub, who stars as Monk, impeccable actor, one of my favorites. So, and he deals with germophobia, for those of you listening who are not familiar. And so that was inspiring and maybe like a negative way in terms of the being hyper aware of like germs and that sort of thing. But I think I was always a kid who didn't want to get super dirty or share like cups or silverware or food with people in that way. I don't know why. I have definitely relaxed a bit on a lot of those things. Because with all this COVID stuff, for the beginning of it, I was the guy who was like, I've been training for this my whole life. You guys are now catching up to me. Like, we should all be wearing masks and washing our hands constantly and all these things. But but I ended up getting it anyway. COVID anyway. And I didn't know it for the longest time. My only symptoms were like a string of migraines for like a few days, mm-hmm. which I suffered from as a kid anyway. So I just thought, I'm super stressed. The world is like going to hell. It's got to be that, right? Because I had no other symptoms. And when I went to go get tested for the nasal swab and the antibody test, I showed up for antibodies. So with that being said, I had this epiphany that I was like, okay, I'm the cleanest person I know, and I still got COVID. So maybe this is just so much more work than it's worth, an effort to be so on everybody and hyper aware of all these germs and these things. So do I want anybody to sneeze on my face in the subway? No. But am I, you know, gonna just like reel it in a little bit with how much I try to put that on other people, or how aggressive I am with some of the other stuff? I've definitely reeled it in a bit, because it's just not worth the stress, you know?
Yeah, I get that. It's interesting how these heightened situations kind of make us realize things. I guess for you, it made you realize that, you know, you could ease up a bit of, you know, COVID is certainly, it certainly made me realize more on an emotional level, just what is it that really drives me? What is it that's really making me happy, that I'm passionate about? And I think that that's something that when you have nothing else to do or to think about, then, you know, these are the thoughts that come to our head.
Absolutely. And in regards to the germophobia, it was very much a thing, especially since, you know, I wrote this and we started shooting it well before COVID was a thing. It's very much like laugh at my pain, not even just with germophobia, but with all the other topics, you know, the racism, the, you know, inside the community and from outside the community, you know, the dynamics with, you know, family and career and all these other things that we kind of expand on. It's all very much like, okay, if I can take a seed of something that bothers me or is a struggle for me or whatever, and really blow it up, and show that to people, and show that I can make fun of myself and all that stuff, people will feel seen. They'll feel empathy. They'll feel sympathy. Several of the episodes, it's been like, oh my God, finally, you know, I deal with that all the time, or I love this episode because I'm also blah, blah, blah. So that's been some of the best compliments that we've gotten, is that they, you know, people will really connect with the messages that we have in the episodes.
Right. Because there was an interview that you did, and you mentioned that you wanted to celebrate minorities instead of exploiting them. And in what ways did you want to celebrate them that you found to be different from other shows or films that you've seen?
I wanted to do a show that really allowed people to turn stereotypes on their heads, allowed them to play characters they wouldn't normally be able to play, or don't even get brought in for. As a result, for example, in our germaphobe episode, we have the actress Jasmine Williams playing Tiffany, you know, very out there as a sort of character, and a black woman with, you know, 4C hair, very dark skin, and, you know, and the body type and everything, as Jasmine has said repeatedly in her own interviews and in personal conversations and stuff like that, would never normally be able to play a character like that, who is very complicated and all over the place and that sort of thing. So that is a big win to do that. Our mugger episode with Brian Michael Smith, who is killing it, mind you. He is an incredible transgender actor who is on 911 Lone Star, the L Word, and you know, every New York procedural that's out here and stuff like that. He's Emmy nominated. He's crushing it. Anyway, point is, him playing that mugger, right? It's like, okay, let's take a character that black people are always having to play, which is like the criminal or whatever, and let's turn it on its head, where you're not just like, you know, your run-of-the-mill mugger. You're this like Robin Hood-esque character who is going to rob the white woman and not the black guy, because you want to make sure that you're taking care of your brother. You're like, what's up, man? You know, nah, I don't want your stuff. You know, I know it's hard out here. Let me get your stuff, cracker, because, you know, it's hard enough out here for all of us. And it turns out that I'm the one who's got the money, and my, you know, Stephanie's character, Polly, doesn't. And so, you know, we berate him for his sort of bizarre reverse racism type thing, right? So it's like always about, how do we tell the stories that haven't been told yet? And how do we make people laugh without exploiting somebody or punching down,
And that's something that I think that we are hopefully doing more of in theater, as far as like thinking outside that box and putting people in roles that aren't dependent upon a certain race or a gender, that really dig into a character and a person and an individual. And that we, you know, that in our own dealings, in our own relationships and how we interact, whether it's the barista or whoever we come in contact with, that we can interact in a way where we're getting to know that person and not judging off some stereotype.
Absolutely. And I mean, look at me, for example. You know, I have no inspiration or mentor or whatever for my type, you know, whatever that means. You know, I'm just ethnically ambiguous, tall, Cape Verdean American, and people don't even know what that is. And I'm constantly mistaken for other things. And so though there is a lot more inclusion and a lot more shows where it's focused on a particular culture, whether it's Indian or Middle Eastern or Black or something, the closest person I have is like a Donald Glover type, who is, you know, quote unquote, not your average Black man. Which, whatever that means, right? But it's like, you know, he talk about hyphenate, who writes, acts, produces, sings, dances, and everything else that you can think of. And he's incredible, and I really look up to him. But even he has your very, I don't want to say stereotypical, but your classic Black features, where, you know, he's not being confused for like another race, where I am. And we are very much, at least personality-wise, like not the same type either. So I am hoping to be the example for other actors who are coming up and other kids who are going to be starting up, to be like, oh man, Alex Pyers is that like ethnically ambiguous, like you can't put your finger on like what background he is, like, you know, where he comes from. Like, is he like, you know, nerdy? Is he like, you know, guy next door? I don't know. Like, maybe he can just do everything or whatever. And that's the hope, right? I don't want to be the one trick pony kind of actor. I want to be the chameleon, where I do this type of thing for Peas in a Pod, but then you see me in other projects and it's like, you know, where did he go? Completely different person.
And this is kind of a big question, but as you were saying that, it just popped into my head. It's, what do you think is that balance between certainly acknowledging and respecting someone's race, ethnicity, but then also letting that go and focusing on the individual, the person who they are and what they bring to the table, regardless of that?
Ooh, big question.
I know, right?
For me, yeah. I mean, you know, you ask a thousand people, you get 1,000 different opinions. For me, somebody's ethnic background is very much a big part of who they are. And that is because, unfortunately, we are still in a time where that is so important for people to know. It's a question that I frequently get, and probably my first conversation with anybody, especially white people, where it's just kind of like, what are you? Where are you from? And those kinds of questions are problematic in a way, because even if you think that you're inquiry is innocent, or just because you want to know, it's very much just, if you really break it down, very much about putting me in some sort of box, or whoever you're asking, some sort of box, so you can feel like, okay, I've got you pegged. I know certain things about you now because I know what your ethnicity is or where your family is from, right? But I also don't think that we need to be in a place where that is irrelevant, right? Because what I am ethnically, which is Cape Verdean, and for those of you who are not familiar with that, or if you're not familiar with that, mm-hmm. Patrick, Cape Verde, Cabo Verde, is a chain of islands off the northwest coast of Africa, west of Senegal, if we're talking about mainland Africa, 10 islands. I have family from several, and it was colonized by the Portuguese, but we got our independence in 1975, so pretty young in terms of that. I, however, was born in Massachusetts, so I am Cape Verdean American, but I'm first generation on my dad's side. So the culture and all this stuff is very much there. I can tell you a lot about the culture, and that's its own thing. So I want that to be a part of the conversation and to be a part of my work. And that's why if you look in Peas in a Pod, there are references, whether they be subtle or overt, to my Cape Verdeanism. Right. But it's not the forefront of who I am. It's a piece of the bigger thing. And so another part of the show and who I am as an actor is to prove that like the show doesn't have to be like, oh, it's a show about some ethnically ambiguous Black guy or some Cape Verdean guy and some Jewish girl or oh, it's this Cape Verdean guy doing this thing, right? It's not about that. It's a show of people struggling to like figure it out in the world. And they also happen to be Cape Verdean and Jewish respectively, or whatever the movie is or whatever the show is, right? Because nobody calls Friends a white show. They just call it a show, a sitcom, right, a comedy, right? And so ideally we get to a place where these creators that are of color are not having to deal with their shows being called black shows or brown shows or Asian shows or whatever. They're just the shows who happen, and they happen to be these people from these different backgrounds that just make the project that much more colorful.
Yeah. It's interesting as I was thinking through, you know, just growing up, the shows that I was watching, it wasn't so much that they were black shows and white shows, even though that some people called it that, but I watched the Jeffersons just as much as I watched Dallas and Cosby Show when it was all right to like Bill Cosby. You know, these were the kind of shows that I grew up on, and it wasn't so much about them being a particular color. It was about them being funny, or, you know, the message or the family dynamic. And I found that no matter the skin color of who I was watching. And then I found in like the late 90s, maybe early 2000s, it kind of went to all the black shows went over here, all the white shows went over here, and I didn't start seeing them as much. Maybe it was my own for not looking for it, but it just seemed like they started to drift apart. And it seems like over the last, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years or so, through Netflix and other places like that are giving a voice to these shows that can just be shows again. Do you see that as well, that they're being more of a mix, so it's not just this is a black show and that's who needs to watch it?
Yeah. So if you're not aware, Michelle Obama just dropped the first episode of her podcast.
Yeah, her podcast, yes.
Shout out to Mish. Because I just think that Michelle and Barack Obama are the pinnacle of just like grace and intelligence and just like a power couple. And I love it. And, you know, I'm just like forever looking for my Michelle. That being said, her first episode had Barack on it because, of course, how do you not start your podcast with your husband and the former president of the United States? My point of bringing this up is, one, listen to that podcast, everybody.
After you listen to this one, of course.
Finish this for sure, because we are equally interesting and have plenty of wonderful things to say. However, when you're finished, immediately go to Spotify and listen to Michelle Obama's podcast. They made a really good point that historically speaking, everything comes in waves. So, you know, especially progress, right? We get a win and there's a little, you know, it gets a little crappy, and then, you know, it comes back and then it's like shit again. And like, you know, we're doing really well with Barack, and then we get this clown and his administration in, and you're like, what is the world coming to? And it's like, that's just how it goes. Unfortunately, you can't just have straight up, like, you know, a 90 degree angle, progress, because it's just not how it works. So with how that relates to this, yeah. I mean, if you go back to the Cosby Show and the Jeffersons and all these other things, other shows, we were, you know, breaking some barriers with those. And, you know, there are these waves of success and trial and error when it comes to some of these things. And most recently, you know, I just found out that all these black shows, quote unquote, for those of you, because you can't see us, are coming to Netflix. So, you know, you got Moesha and the Parkers and Girlfriends and all these other shows that are like, you know, predominantly like black casts. And it's like, these shows are so good. And what these shows really do is prove that there are issues that are human issues. And so I think it humanizes these margins, going back to like why I want to celebrate instead of exploit and all that stuff. All these shows and what I'm trying to do with mine and all my work is to humanize people of color and these marginalized groups, to show that we have much more in common than we do, than we don't. And to have people that thought that they had to hate other groups go, oh man, I'm, you know, they're also dealing with like trying to find like the love of their life and, you know, career success and personal happiness and getting over their own idiosyncrasies and all these things, like me too. Wow. Maybe I can take my head out of my ass and just be a little more like friendly and respectful of other human beings, right? And slowly we will kind of tear down ignorance and bigotry and all this other stuff.
It's a big wall to tear down, but you know, it's brick by brick. That's all we can do is just take it down.
Yeah.
one little step at a time. And were there those walls that came up for you?
Daily, all the time. I mean, I've been called tons of slurs. Everything that's in the show is you know, some sort of battle that I have either been working on or recently accomplished or, you know, what have you. And, you know, it's not always obvious, but, you know, there are days when, you know, I'm walking down the street and I can't tell if the look that I'm getting from someone is them being, you know, afraid of me, them being judgmental of like how I look or how I'm dressed or whatever the case is. I'm constantly misidentified as some sort of other race or other sexuality or something like that. And so there's been a lot of work personally to ignore a lot of that stuff and not be as bothered and worried about it. And because, you know, if you live and breathe by everybody else's opinions and their judgment and all that stuff, then you're just going to go crazy. And I don't want to be that celebrity or that person that is so bogged down by people's judgment and like the ugliness that exists in the world that I can't do wonderful things that I planned on doing. So, but yeah, I mean, it's a daily battle against the evils of the world, but we got to keep fighting because it'll never change if we just accept, you know, the cards that we've been dealt.
Was there a particular moment or something that, that kind of drove that home for you?
How much time you got, Beth? How much time you got? Yeah. So I'll give you two quick ones.
Okay.
My first job was a cashier bagger at Stop and Shop back in Massachusetts. It's like a big grocery store, for those of you who don't know what that is. And this one customer behind me thought I was talking trash about a customer who just passed through my line. And she called me a sand N-word, was screaming at me or whatever, as she was leaving like the store, thinking that I was saying all this stuff. And myself and my bagger were trying to convince, it's not what you thought you heard. We don't even know where you're coming from, blah, blah, blah. And she just kept screaming that slur, sand N-word, until, you know, she eventually like left the store. And that was like so embarrassing and just like, you know, if I could turn red, I would have, in just like embarrassment and just like shock, because I had never been like blatantly called out by like a stranger in a public setting in that way. And I'm like 15, 16, you know? And so that was like, whoa. So there was that. And then there's, and honestly, quickly, there's been times where like, I'm constantly like, you know, misidentified as gay or bi or something like that. And people always try to explain it as, oh, well, you're so articulate and you're so, you know, manicured and well-dressed and your fingernails are clipped and just weird things like that. And it's like, well, did you catch me having sex with a man? Or because otherwise, why would you make that assumption? Right. And there's just like, that's just culture. Right. And then another thing that very much shows itself in the show is that I'm constantly misidentified as Indian, even by Indian people. So if you've seen the bodega episode that we have, I had to sort of have it where everyone in this store thinks that I work there and that I'm Indian. And we sort of have that discovery right then and there.
Sir, well, sir, there's no price tag on the milk. Can you tell me how much a gallon of the 2% is?
I don't work here, lady.
Come on, I've seen you here before.
I was probably buying something.
Oh, you're V-Cash's kid. He told me you were a trickster.
V-Cash? You think I'm Indian?
Come on, Junior. Is the milk on sale or what?
I don't want to give anything away, but audience, please go watch that episode because, you know, it has a very explosive sort of climax to that episode. But these are all things that I'm dealing with constantly. And sometimes it's like a micro thing, where somebody's like, you know, are you Indian? And I'm like, no, and I have to go through the whole thing. But it does, my fighting against it is that I get to then explain to people, no, I'm not Indian, but I am Cape Verdean, and they don't know what that is. And I get to educate people on something that they never heard about and share the beautiful culture that is Cape Verdean culture. So there is a silver lining in that regard.
I never assume based upon skin color where someone's from, because anyone can really be from anywhere. Once I hear an accent, that's certainly when I'm trying to like piece it. Oh, is that German? Is it, you know, Japanese? Is it, you know, I think we do, even unconsciously. We want to kind of put people, oh, if I know you're Japanese, okay, I used to live in Japan, so I can relate to that. Or, oh, I've been to Italy, you have an Italian accent. So we try to like put people in these things like that we understand. So that way, you know, for me, it's so I can relate to them better, but I'm sure in other people, it's so that they can have a certain idea of what that person is or isn't.
Right. And even in your case, I mean, I know you don't mean it maliciously, but even right there, in terms of relating to someone, just because you lived in Japan or you've been to Italy or whatever, doesn't mean that that has anything to do with how that person was brought up or how they live or what. They might not be connected to that culture at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, they might be totally Americanized, or even if that is like their culture, maybe they don't want someone being like, oh, well, let me tell you about what I know about Japan because I can, or whatever it is. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's very to each their own.
Yeah.
And in terms of the accent, that's another thing that throws people off about me, because I have a very non-regional accent. So they're like, what are you? You know, and I used to have a very, very Massachusetts accent, and I just did my own. So I never did a class or any sort of workshop or whatever. I just realized that I was going to be made fun of big time if I didn't, you know, whatever. And I also, as an actor, wanted to make myself as versatile as possible. So I worked very hard to make what you're hearing now very comfortable. So I'm not putting this on anymore. But, and as a matter of fact, to do my original accent, I almost have to put that back on now, or hang out with my family or friends from back there for like a couple days, and it starts to kind of come out naturally again. And then I can, you know, sort of slip into it without thinking about it.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I'm from Alabama. So whenever I go back to Alabama, if I've been there a few days or I'm around my family, then it can start to come out a little bit. But yeah, it's one of those things where I don't have to unforce that accent. But it is one of those that I remember one time I needed to play a character from Alabama. So I was like, well, great. All right. So I just kind of put on that accent again of one that I had, or closer to probably what my mother has. And he was like, that doesn't sound right. I was like, well, this is what it is. But I think what they wanted is someone who had literally just like come out of the outhouse and was wiping their butt as they were spitting tobacco. I mean, I think they wanted something that was so over the top that
right.
Is no one from Alabama that I know, you know, yeah. That kind of
a thing. Caricature of a human being, you know?
Yes. Like- yeah. As we, you know, encounter people, as we have these interactions, I think we're trying to find that balance of respecting who the person is, respecting wherever they come from, but also at the same time taking them one by one as individuals. And I think that there's just the pendulum's kind of swinging both ways for those of us with good intentions and approaching this with respect. Of course, I'm not talking about the stupid idiots, but those who are well-meaning and want this to be something that is fruitful and that can progress.
Absolutely. We are definitely making progress, and I don't mean to sound cynical at all. I can name show after show, movie after movie where, you know, it's beautiful what they're doing. And I'm so glad that, you know, these projects are finally being made and these conversations are being had, much like this one, about how it all makes sense. And hopefully anybody that's listening to this, and even you, Pat, will think even more about, you know, relations and respect. And, you know, we're in a movement. You know, there are still protests happening daily. And, you know, even though I'm Cape Verdean American, between that being part of the African continent and everything else, I consider myself Black, and my skin tone supports it. So there's that. So those struggles are struggles that I deal with as well. So while we're, you know, physically protesting and, you know, putting our money towards these, you know, specific groups and all that stuff to get justice and stuff, let's all continue to allow conversations to happen so that way we can find middle ground and everybody can get on the same page of true justice and true equality. Because again, if we don't keep fighting for it, it's never going to happen.
It may be cliche to say that there is more that joins us than divides us, but until more people believe it, then it continually needs to be said. And in his own way, through his own experiences, Alex is telling stories of acceptance and commonality with a splash of humor thrown in. He is saying what needs to be said, and I look forward to the work and creative projects he will use to continue saying it. Thank you to Alex, and a big thanks to you for joining us today. If you know someone who would benefit from this conversation, please share this episode with them. It's listeners like you that bring me back week after week with guests like Alex, who share openly and passionately from the heart. Now, as you know from listening to the podcast for the past couple of months, I was conducting a survey where you could give your own feedback on this podcast and the best ways to connect and reach a wider audience. Well, as it turns out, 56 people went to the online survey. However, only 5 completed it. Sometimes the name of this podcast is quite apropos. Nonetheless, I am grateful for your thoughts, and while it's hard to gauge consensus from just 5 respondents, I'll certainly be doing my best to continually improve and grow this podcast. In fact, with regard to the upcoming final 5 episode, 3 of the 5 suggested that it be a part of this main episode rather than its own bonus episode. So stay tuned for those final 5 questions with Alex, and we'll see where the final 5 eventually finds its home. Well, I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, reminding you that the reasons for not making it may seem countless and frustrating, but the reasons to keep going are even more numerous and rewarding. Let's get together next time as we talk more about why I'll never make it.